It's my honor and my great pleasure this afternoon to introduce our moderator, the Honorable Joshua Walson. Before Josh became a judge in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania in May of 2019, he was a partner here in Philadelphia at Dilworth Paxson. Before that, he was an associate in Washington at Covington and Burling. He clerked on the Eastern District of Pennsylvania for Judge Du Bois, and of course, he graduated from Penn Law here in Philadelphia. Josh, the favorite part of Josh's resume, from my perspective, is that he is also the former chapter president of the Philadelphia Federalist Society, and he's been a great friend of the chapter since graduating from that role, and he's graciously agreed to moderate today. So thank you, Judge Walson.
Of course. All right. So thanks, everybody, for having me, and welcome, and my apologies that we're running a little late. I was stuck actually picking a jury, which is something I haven't done in a long time. And to quote Will Ferrell, I misunderestimated it as to how long it would take. But I'm here now, and if the plus side of that was that you got more time with Professor George, I don't think anybody's complaining. So let me introduce our panelists. Our topic today is school choice, particularly in a COVID-19 world. And so to my immediate left is Robert Eitel. Bob is a co-founder and president of Defense of Freedom Institute for Policy Studies, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that promotes freedom, choice, and opportunity for America's families, students, entrepreneurs, and workers. DFI fights to expand education and work opportunities for all Americans to reduce the power of the federal government and the influence of government sector unions in education and workforce policy, and to defend the civil and constitutional rights of all Americans in the classroom and the workplace. He served as senior counselor to Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos from 2017 through 2020. He was also the Deputy General Counsel of the Department of Education from 2005 until 2009. Prior to joining the department in 2017, Bob was the Vice President for Regulatory Compliance Matters for several post-secondary institutions. He practiced education and employment law in Washington, D.C. Before he came to the department in 2005, he practiced law in New Orleans, where he was litigating commercial employment and bankruptcy cases in Louisiana, Texas, and Mississippi. He earned an AB in history from Georgetown. He studied British government and international politics at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and he received his law degree from Tulane University. And then to Bob's left is Benjamin Field. Ben is an attorney with the Institute for Justice. Prior to joining IJ in 2021, Ben was a member of the appellate group at Hogan Lovells, where his practice focused on the Supreme Court and federal courts of appeals. Before that, Ben clerked for Judge Darman O'Scanlan of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and he clerked for Judge Kent Jordan on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Ben received a law degree in 2015 from Yale Law School and an AB in economics from the University of Chicago in 2010. So, what we're going to do for this panel is I'm going to turn it over initially to Bob for some remarks. His remarks will feed naturally into Ben's remarks, and so then Ben will spend another, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15 minutes talking to you about some of the issues that are on his docket. And then we're going to go to some question and answer, some discussion. I will try and focus some of those questions, but I will encourage all of you to participate as well. Don't be shy. Put your hands up. Speak up. And so start thinking now, because, you know, I can be a hot bench, so I may just call on you. All right. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bob.
Thank you, Judge, and I appreciate the Federalist Society having us here today. I thought what I would do is provide you with some information, statistical information, about the state of schools in the United States in the wake of the pandemic, and classify it by public schools, charter public schools, home schools, and Catholic schools. And it probably was not very prudent of me to decide to provide a statistical overview in the wake of a speech from Robbie George, but right after lunch, but I'll try to do that. So let's there's sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly concerning enrollment statistics for schools across the United States in the wake of the pandemic. We'll start with the ugly first, and those concern public schools. And this is based on Department of Education data that's been compiled in the last year. Between 2019, the fall of 2019 and the fall of 2020, public school enrollments dropped 3% nationally. That, in raw numbers, that's about 1.5 million students in a student population of about 51 million. What's important to note is that while this may seem a small drop, it's actually the largest drop in two decades. With every single state, it's experiencing a decline. So clearly, there has been, based on the preliminary data, a flight from public schools. When you dig into the data and look at it by grade level, pre-K, the drop was 22%. For kindergartners, it was 9%. So clearly, there are a number of academic red shirts in the 4 to 6 year old range for pre-K and K. As you go up the chain, however, the numbers get smaller. So grades 1 through 8, the drop was 3%. For high school, secondary school 9 to 12, it was 0.4%, relatively insignificant. What's also interesting to note is that there's no red state, blue state divide on this. The biggest losses in terms of percentage were Mississippi and Vermont, those jurisdictions that had the least loss were D.C. and South Dakota. I know this is the Third Circuit, so I thought it would be interesting to go into the data for Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. Pennsylvania, the drop was about 3.18%. That's about 51,000 plus students. New Jersey, 3.37%, that's about 34,000 plus students. Delaware, a little less, 2.39%, or about 2,900 students. Interesting to note, in Pennsylvania, the decline was solely in the 10 largest by population counties. Those counties lost 54,500 students. The remaining counties in Pennsylvania actually increased public school enrollment by about 3,300. So you have a net loss of about 51,000 plus students. There's reasons for this. We can go into them in conversation later. But there are a number of theories as to why that is. Some of them obvious, some of them not so. So what's the good about what happened in the last 20 months from the fall of 19 to the fall of 20? The National Association of Public Charter Schools just released a study that looked at how public charter schools fared during the pandemic, at least for that first year. And the news is very good. Between the fall of 19 and the fall of 20, enrollments in public charter schools were up 7%, or about 237,000 students. That's based on data from 41 states. Certainly. Yep. Thank you. That's based on data from about 41 states. Two states that have charter schools, Kansas and Tennessee, did not provide data, and the balance of the country does not have charter schools. So you've got about now 3.58 million kids in 7,700 schools. Pennsylvania, you are up 15.5%. That's about 22,600 students. New Jersey, you're up 3.4%. It's about 1,800 students. Delaware, you are up 3.3%, 544 students. One reason Pennsylvania was up so much compared to the national statistics in those regionally is that apparently you all have cyber charter schools here that were very popular, and they enrolled nearly all of the increase, about 22,000 of the 22,600 plus students. Interestingly, too, the greatest increase was in Oklahoma, 77% increase, driven mostly by a virtual charter school. So apparently, you know, parents are going to the virtual school context when there is a viable alternative to public schools being provided. Texas was up 29,000 students, or 8.6%. They didn't have a charter school, so go figure. There are only three states with charter schools that had decreases. It was Iowa, Wyoming, and Illinois, and they were very small decreases. The other good news relates to homeschooling. Homeschooling took off during the pandemic. Between the spring of 2020 and the spring of 2021, and this is based on Census Bureau data in connection with a survey that was taken, the number of households in the United States homeschooling children, this is households, not students, more than doubled from 5.4% to 11.1%. Among black households, that number went from 3.3% to 16.1%. It's pretty remarkable. In Pennsylvania, you had about a 50% increase. In New Jersey, it was more than doubled. Delaware, the increase was relatively de minimis. So homeschooling has done very well. It's been discussed during the pandemic that there's been this flood from the public schools to private schools and to parochial schools, and there's this assumption that this has occurred. Well, the data's not showing that. The data on private schools generally non-secular is iffy, so I'm not going to go into that. There has not been a sound study done yet. But the National Catholic Educational Association did a survey, which they released earlier this year, and there has been a precipitous decline in Catholic school enrollment and the number of Catholic schools nationally. So it's distressing. From the fall of 19 to the fall of 20, Catholic school enrollments dropped 6.4%. They lost 110,000 students. This is the largest decline in 50 years. It's a larger decline than occurred in 2003 because of the clergy sex abuse scandal when that occurred. It is worse than occurred during the Great Recession of 2008. What's particularly bothersome is that most of these schools that closed, most of them were elementary schools, the vast majority were elementary schools, and most of these schools were in, frankly, the jurisdictions in the areas that needed them, Title I neighborhoods, African-American neighborhoods in the inner city, urban areas. Those schools with those characteristics were more than twice as likely to close than those in affluent areas. Interestingly, similar to the public schools, there was a precipitous drop in Catholic pre-K enrollment, which dropped 26.6%. And in Delaware, it dropped, that demographic dropped 42%. Here in Philadelphia, your Catholic schools lost 5% of their enrollment, or about 3,000 students. Other states, even those with strong pro-choice school choice programs, were down. Enrollments were down significantly. In Arizona, 5.8%, Ohio, 3.8%, Indiana, over 7%, Florida, 6.5%. So the news is not good. Now, what is interesting to note is that nearly 40% of all Catholic schools that did not close reported having to waitlist students for the 2020-21 school year, and people surmise that that is a result of waitlisting for COVID, arising from COVID spacing restrictions for the last school year. But the people don't, until people get more data and dig into it, we won't know. This is all simply to say, particularly in reference to private schools and Catholic schools, that this is no time for supporters of school choice to rest on our laurels and to assume that people are leaving the public schools in droves and enrolling their kids in private schools and parochial schools. The data is not showing that. There's a real need here. And for people like Ben, who are litigating these issues daily, and others of supporters of school choice need to understand that the fight's not over. So now I think, Ben, you're going to talk about some cases and pending legislation.
Yes. So I will pick up from the somewhat bleak picture that Bob gave us and hopefully be a little bit cheerier with some of the great new programs that have been enacted by the states in the wake of COVID, the litigation that that spawned. And then I'd like to end by just giving you a preview of a critical case that's at the Supreme Court this term that's very important for school choice. And I'll just preface it by saying that I'll be drawing on the work that the Institute for Justice does. We've sort of been at the forefront of litigating for school choice for the last three decades. But if I say anything crazy, those are my own views, not IJ's. So first of all, I want to talk about new legislation that's happened in the wake of COVID-19. And before getting into exactly what's happened, I want to just lay the groundwork. Many people are not aware of exactly, you know, what the types of school choice programs are. And so I just want to give a brief primer on that, and then we'll dive into what the states have been doing. So most people, when they think of school choice, think of publicly funded scholarship programs, sometimes called vouchers. And so the idea of that is that, you know, you get to take some portion of the money that your state or locality that would have allocated to your public school, and you get to take it to the school of your choice. So those exist, but they're not the most common form of school choice, actually. So more popular in many states are tax benefit funded scholarship programs. So rather than taking the public money directly, what a state does is it offers either individual taxpayers or corporate taxpayers a substantial tax credit or tax deduction in exchange for making a donation to a private scholarship granting organization, which then administers scholarships for students, which they can then take to the school of their choice. And there's sort of a wrinkle on that, which is called education savings accounts, which are similarly can either be funded directly with public funds or through the tax credit scheme. But in both cases, they allow you to make a broader set of decisions with your money. So you could stay in the public school and spend the money on transportation or tutoring or you know, special needs therapy, or hold on to the money and use it for higher education. So these are lots of different options that are available. There's another set of things which are, you know, direct tax deductions to you if you use the money for private schools. Most of those aren't so great. They're largely just rewarding people who have the resources to go to private school anyway. One notable exception is Alabama, which makes it fully refundable so that even a family that doesn't have a large tax liability can get the money to use on private schools. And these are distinct from the public charters that Bob was talking about. You know, public charters are great. They give more choice. But at the end of the day, they're still run by the government and are beholden to the government. And the government can take them back at any point. So we tend to be champions at IJ and in most of the school choice community of these options that will actually give people resources to make a choice rather than having to be dependent on their local school board. So the current state of school choice in the country is that there are over 76 programs nationwide. And this year, 18 states passed legislation in the 2021 session. They expanded 21 existing programs and enacted 7 new programs. So people have referred to this as the year of school choice. Those invariably, if you see that on the internet, there's a link to a National Review article by Jeb Bush calling it the year of school choice. I don't know if he coined it, but he's done great work in school choice going back to his time as governor, so I'm happy to credit him with the term. So some of the highlights that states have enacted. So I think the one that at least I'm most excited about is West Virginia's new program. It's called the HOPE Scholarship Program, and this is kind of like the gold standard for a scholarship program. It is the most expansive program in the country. Parents can receive 100% of the per pupil state funding that would go to their public school and can take it with them to the school of their choice. And 93% of students in the state are eligible for the program. They can use it for private school tuition, for tutoring, for credentialing, for therapies, for transportation, and more. So this really is, you know, sort of the apotheosis of school choice, where the state is saying, we are going to fund families and students, not public school administrations, and you can take your money and do what you want to do with it. That has not yet spawned a legal challenge, but several plaintiffs have been saying they're going to sue for several months. We'll see what actually happens. We anticipate a challenge to that. When they do, IJ will be there to intervene and defend the program. And then another program, something I'd like to talk about is Kentucky, which is near and dear to my heart because I am counsel to parents who have intervened to defend that program against the lawsuit brought by the National Education Association, which you probably know is the largest teachers union in the country. And wherever there is a school choice program, there the NEA is to bring a lawsuit against it. So this program in Kentucky is the kind of tax credit funded education saving account that I was talking about. It's targeted towards low and middle income families. Unlike West Virginia, there's a cap, so it's capped at $25 million annually, which means that it could fund about 5,000 EOAs for families, each of about $5,000. And that's great, but it's only 0.6% of Kentucky's 781,000 K-12 students. So we're very excited about the program. I'm very happy to be defending it. But this is sort of emblematic of school choice programs across the country, that at the end of the day, they're hitting still a pretty small percentage of people, and there's still a lot of work to be done. And now I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about the Third Circuit specifically. So Pennsylvania is where all the action is within the Third Circuit. So Pennsylvania has two ESA programs. They expanded one of them, their bigger one, this legislative session. So that's the Educational Improvement Tax Credit, the EITC, which unfortunately shares a name with another program at the federal level that I also really like, but love them both. This one was originally enacted in 2001. It is a tax credit program funded exclusively through corporate tax credits, and it can be used, so the corporate entity makes a donation to a nonprofit organization, and that organization can either use the money to provide private school scholarships, it can support innovation in public schools, or it can provide pre-K scholarships. The program's tailored to low and middle income families, and the average scholarship is only about $2,000. And so what Pennsylvania did in this legislative session is it expanded the cap for the K through 12 portion of the program from $135 million to $175 million, which can actually be a little bit higher. This is common in many states, that if the donor makes a multi-year pledge, the cap actually goes up a little bit. EdChoice, which is one of the premier organizations that tracks statistics in this area, estimates that based on previous expansions, an additional 13,000 students in Pennsylvania might take advantage of this. Unfortunately, the reach is still modest. As I said, the program is only, on average, about a $2,000 scholarship, which is only 13% of the average per student spending that Pennsylvania provides to local school districts. And there are 2 million K-12 students in Pennsylvania statewide, so this expansion of, 10, 13,000 students is still kind of a drop in the bucket. Pennsylvania has another tax credit program called the Opportunity Scholarship Tax Credit. It's targeted more towards low-achieving school districts. That one wasn't expanded this year. It's still a good program, but I won't get into the details since there isn't a specific COVID tie-in. So New Jersey and Delaware, nothing to report and probably nothing on the horizon. But I would like to say a couple things about them. So first of all, if you're from New Jersey or Delaware and you're interested in this, I hope that you'll write to your state legislators and ask them to do something. But I think it's also important to realize that this is opposition to school choice. It's certainly the case that the most vociferous opponents are the teachers' unions who, you often think of them being affiliated, with one political party in cities. But they're far from the only opponents. And often suburban and rural districts and representatives think like, oh, school choice is for other people. They're not for me. And so if you're from those areas, I would encourage you to write to your representative, to them as well, because, you may think that, your local school's doing great for you, but it might not be perfect for every family. And every family should get a chance to decide, is this school district, even if it's in a nice suburban school district, is this school working for me? If it is, they can stay in the public school. But if not, everybody's taxes are being levied to support those families. We think that they should get the chance to make that decision for themselves. So, you know, hopefully New Jersey and Delaware will join the party soon. So litigation that's arisen out of these cases. So, as I said, I'm representing parents who have intervened to defend the new Kentucky program. As I said, the NEA is directly bringing suit. So school choice litigation has evolved over the last decade or so. Back 20, 30 years ago, challenges were almost exclusively under the Establishment Clause and arguing that the federal constitution barred school choice because money would go towards schools with a religious affiliation. The Supreme Court, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, has scaled back the viability of those challenges. And so what the teachers' unions have done instead, and I'm borrowing a phrase from the former general counsel of the NEA, is they've picked up quote-unquote Mickey Mouse provisions in state constitutions, and they'll just comb through a state constitution and find anything they can that might implicate a school choice program, and we'll throw it at the wall. So Kentucky's a good example of that. The challengers have raised about a dozen state constitutional provisions. So, for instance, you've got claiming that there's a non-delegation problem by having these private organizations grant the tuitions. There's a section in the Kentucky Constitution requiring the provision of efficient public schools, and the plaintiffs are arguing that somehow private schools are, by providing this indirect aid to private schools, the state, which isn't changing its public school funding at all, is somehow falling down on the job there. So you have all these things. Interestingly enough, Kentucky does have a Blaine Amendment, which is this class of constitutional provisions which are common throughout the country, which were enacted in the 19th century to target Catholic schools because students didn't want to be in the predominantly Protestant schools. Kentucky does have a Blaine Amendment, which could very easily be read to say that the state cannot provide aid directly, indirectly of any sort to schools that are religious. But I think it's quite telling that the plaintiffs have not raised the Blaine Amendment because the Supreme Court has made quite clear that it's, to the extent Blaine Amendments still exist, they are not long for this world because they violate the free exercise clause of the federal constitution. So we're also litigating cases in North Carolina, Tennessee, and Nevada, and I'm happy to talk about if there are questions about that. But I'd just like to spend a couple minutes at the end talking about going back to this Blaine Amendment issue and talking about a Supreme Court case that's going to be heard in December of this year called Carson. So Carson is sort of the hopefully terminus of a line of cases dating back to a case versus Zelman versus Simmons-Harris in 2002. So as I said, traditionally what opponents of school choice have said is that school choice violates the Establishment Clause. For historically contingent reasons, in a world without school choice, really most of the schools that are available are either very posh non-sectarian schools, which aren't really within reach for most students, or religious schools. And the reason that there aren't secular schools that sort of at the same price point as the religious schools is just because they have to compete against this free good of public schools. And so it's the religious institutions that have the resources and the wherewithal to have this separate system. And so that's sort of historically contingent. So any school choice program at the start is going to be predominantly taken advantage of by students in religious schools. Though over time, when you actually have a school choice program, you get a wide variety of options. And so traditionally, it was Establishment Clause challenges based on something called the Lemon Test, which you all probably know about, and which I'll just mention, because the Lemon case actually arose from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, a three-judge panel that went straight up to the Supreme Court after that. But in 2002, applying the Lemon Test in a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said, no, a school choice program that is neutral and simply gives families money and they can choose what to do with it does not violate the Establishment Clause, because if a family is choosing to attend a religious school, that's the family's choice. It is not the state's choice, and therefore there isn't an Establishment Clause violation. So that really opened the door for states to start experimenting with school choice because they wouldn't face this instant Establishment Clause challenge. But you still had situations with these Blaine Amendments. So there common across the country. As I said, they were originally enacted to discriminate against Catholics. And so you have all these states that have these Blaine Amendments. As I said, you know, when you create a school choice program, a lot of the students are going to start going to Catholic schools or other parochial schools. And so you had this problem where the Blaine Amendments were essentially a barrier to school choice in the first instance. But after a case called Trinity Lutheran in 2017, which had to do with giving grants for resurfacing playgrounds, the Supreme Court said, you can't exclude a church from the program just because they're a church. That was expanded in 2020 to really take on Blaine Amendments in the school choice context head on. So in this case called Espinoza out of Montana, the Montana Supreme Court had said, well, we have a Blaine Amendment. We realize that there's a potential free exercise problem to excluding private schools, so we're just going to kill the entire school choice program so that there's no concern whatsoever. You can't go to you can't go to secular schools, you can't go to Catholic schools. And the Supreme Court said, no, if you're striking down a program because you want to exclude religious schools, that's a free exercise problem in and of itself. And the Supreme Court said, you can't exclude schools from a public benefits program just because they are religiously affiliated. But some people after that, some states in New England, which have tuitioning programs, so in small rural counties in New England states, they don't operate public schools, so they give families the money they would otherwise spend on public schools, and you can go to a school of your choice, but they exclude religious schools. And they came up with a rationale, well, we're not excluding them because they're religious schools, we're excluding them because they use the money for religious instruction. So they came up with this status versus use distinction, which the Supreme Court is going to consider this term, whether or not that's a viable distinction whatsoever. My colleague Michael Bindis is going to be arguing that in December, and our point of view is quite straightforward. You know, you can say you're excluding the school. There's no real difference between saying, well, we're excluding you because you're religious, or we're excluding you because you do religious things. These schools provide all of the same secular requirements that a public school would. The fact that they have some religious instruction on top of that, you know, to say that they can't participate, we think is squarely a free exercise violation. And the fact that you have these states having to, you know, audit the schools and decide just how religious they are also raises an establishment clause and an equal protection violation. So we're hopeful that that's going to be, that we'll win that case. That'll be the end of the Blaine Amendments. And then we'll just, there will still be lots of litigation to be done, but it'll be against these Mickey Mouse state constitutional provisions rather than the federal constitution.
Great. Thank you both. Very interesting. We're going to move to some questions and hopefully some discussion. If there are questions in the audience, speak up and we can start there and then I'll jump in as to see if it's. So, yeah, go ahead.
So my understanding of the West Virginia bill is it's the first one in the country where any kindergartner is eligible for the choice program and the funding that comes with it, which seems really good. But I guess public education has been a disaster for a while. So why is West Virginia, do you think, the first state in the country that's actually passed this? And do you think, in light of debates about CRT, debates about closures and masking, more states may do the same thing in the years to come?
So unfortunately, I'm a litigator, not a lobbyist, so I don't know the ins and outs of what happened in the West Virginia State House. But I think that there are a few reasons. I think that, you know, West Virginia has, you know, there's a supermajority, you know, Republican legislature, and that tends to be the party that supports school choice. And so I think you sort of a nice situation where it was large enough, you know, with an aligned governor that, you know, these dissenters that I was talking about weren't able to carry the day. So in Kentucky, for instance, you know, there's a supermajority of Republicans in the legislature, but the governor vetoed the bill, and then when it came back for an override, it passed by a very slim margin. And I don't think that would have been possible without the supermajority in the first place. So I think West Virginia is probably in a similar situation where the supermajority, you know, allows you to fight back against the teachers' unions. And, you know, in terms of whether we're going to see something like West Virginia elsewhere, you know, I think it would be wonderful. I think that a lot of the culture war fights that we have in the country, you know, coming from both directions, would be solved if people could just, you know, take their public, the benefit of school funding and go to a school that meets their needs and their family's values. And those are going to be different schools for different people. And so I think that it really would be a great way to lower the temperature. You know, pluralism, you know, James Madison acknowledged was like the way that a republic can work across, you know, large distances. But unfortunately, when it comes to public schools, we don't embrace that pluralistic view. It's a very much one size fits all. And we're hopeful that there will be expansion and that West Virginia will be a model. But, you know, it is still an outlier. And even in other states that have expanded this year, it hasn't been nearly to the universal extent of West Virginia. So, you know, I think it's going to be a long slog just based on history, but I'm hopeful that, you know, that West Virginia can be a model, especially if, you know, as I said, like it was only 2002 that Zelman versus Simmons Harris was decided and when these programs really started to happen. So we only really now have one generation of data, and hopefully, you know, people will see the results, will see the success, and it can lead to expansion elsewhere.
I mean, I think one reason you had a precipitous decline in public school enrollments, sort of that full year of the pandemic, was because of uncertainty over the virus, uncertainty over COVID, a little bit of fear. And if you look at the statistics that show there was a heavy disenrollment of kids in pre-K and K, I think that would underscore that. You could keep your child out for a year with little academic interruption, do some homeschooling perhaps. I think what's going to keep them out of the public schools are just the issues that you identified, the debates over critical race theory, the illiberalism within K-12 that Robert George spoke about earlier today, controversies over gender identity theory. When you add that to current debates over masking that you're seeing played out across the country, as well as disagreements over vaccinations and mandatory vaccinations, I think that this disenrollment factor that you see occur in the public schools is going to increase. And the question is, where are those parents going to go? Are they going to homeschool? Are they in a state where there's an alternative opportunity? And I think to your implicit point, I suspect there will be a increase in support for school choice. That's why I hear anecdotally from folks. In a state, I'm from Virginia. That is a state that is, frankly, anti-charter school. You'll be pleased to hear that, man. But not that great on school choice because, frankly, the public schools have been so good. But you may have seen in the national media disputes over critical race theory in Loudoun County, Virginia. That's hit the national stage. Parents are outraged. These are, frankly, blue state or light blue voters who don't like what they are seeing in their public school and they want an alternative.
Let me pick up on a couple things you just said and ask him. So as we think about, for example, a program like West Virginia's and Bob, you know, if someone were interested in building the case, right, to expand that program to other states, what data metrics do you think they should be looking at in the short and medium term to prove the success of the program? I mean, enrollment's one, and it seems like it's a very sort of top level, but are there other metrics that people can look to?
Are you talking about metrics of the school choice program?
Metrics of its success, I guess. And enrollment is a proxy in some respects for its success, right? Parent buy-in. But are there others as well?
I mean, I think you can look at things like for dropout rates, retention rates, you know, if there's a college preparatory focus, whether students are graduating and A, finding a job, or B, going to college or vo-tech school.
Yeah.
So I think that those are the metrics that you look at. I think, you know, there are national like the Department of Education has a national test that it does, which is standardized across the country. And often, you know, in the school choice debates, people look at that as the measure of, you know, trying to compare different schools, public charters versus public schools versus magnet schools versus private schools that people can attend with choice programs. But I would like to push back against the premise a little bit, because I think that the strongest argument for school choice at the end of the day is not, you know, there, whenever you get into empirical debates, like, I think that the evidence is quite strong that people who take advantage of choice programs or take advantage of charters, those students on average are doing better. And the opponents usually say, well, that's a function of those schools cherry picking the best students. And you get into this like very circular debate over, you know, trying to tease that out and do regression analysis to figure it out. And I think that's all beside the point, because I think at the end of the day, what matters is a family happy with the school that they're attending? And if their public school is doing well for them, then a choice program isn't going to change their behavior. But if they're not happy, you know, the point, we all pay taxes in order to support families and their education. And if they're not happy with it, you know, we should be giving them an alternative. And I think that it's more that dignitary liberty interest that at the end of the day is the more compelling case.
So let me follow up on that, because that was actually my next question. You talked a little bit about the sort of pluralism, the concept of pluralism in education. Isn't a school choice program really driving students into some sort of balkanized world where essentially everyone's going to kind of go their own way? They're going to hole up in their own little world and, you know, not be exposed to anyone of a differing view. And is that a problem?
Good. Sure. So I actually used to somewhat feel more sympathetic to that, but I don't now for a variety of reasons. So first is just empirically, I don't think the status quo is not this idyllic version where, you know, every public school in the country is this lyceum where everybody's engaging in heady debates about philosophical topics. Instead, you have school, like the places where school choice are most needed, like they're not even teaching, students cannot even read at grade level. And so it seems like we need to get to that before we can start talking about political debates. Second, like, public schools are also incredibly segregated along racial lines, along class lines. And in places where there are school choice programs, you actually get more diversity across those lines. So I think the pluralism actually plays out better under a choice program. And I guess finally, I think that when you have this one-size-fits-all approach, it encourages a level of culture war, and you know it's a zero-sum game, and so I think you end up having much more of a fight than you otherwise would. And you know, as a libertarian in FedSoc, I often feel like the need to be a little bit of a gadfly, and it's not just the CRT side. There has been, I think, way overreactions to CRT. So like David French has written powerfully about how in his rural community in Tennessee, the anti-CRT side has like routed the CRT side and is now trying to ban books about Martin Luther King and Ruby Bridges. And so you can have this other extreme. And when these fights were happening in the 2000s, remember, it was, you know, fights over teaching evolution in school, where it was, you know, the cultural conservatives who were the aggressors. And I think the only way to get out of this constant culture war over the schools is to give families choice.
So there's Attorney General William Barr recently gave a speech to Alliance Defending Freedom. And if you haven't read it or listened to it, I suggest that you do. In that speech, he talks about sort of the three phases of American education. And the first phase was sort of the 19th century notion that public schools are for the common good. That common good would be defined by sort of this pan-Protestantism, to the exclusion of Catholics and Jews, but that would be the accepted view of the world that would be inculcated into students. And the second phase occurred after World War II, with sort of the rise of secularism, where that sort of Horace Mann view of public schooling sort of migrated to this neutral, benign, value-free, secularized education that sort of engaged in an easy tension, a balanced tension between those who disagreed. And that was sort of the posture of American public schools until very recently. And in the last several years, and I think this is probably where Ben and I disagree a bit, I would take the view, and this is this third phase that Attorney General Barr spoke about, is that we are in an era now, and it's happened very rapidly, where there is a progressive radical agenda that has overtaken school districts throughout the United States, and particularly in urban areas in major metropolitan areas, with its own sacraments, and Professor George alluded to it earlier today. And these students are being churned out with an ideological view of the world because of what they've heard in K-12. What sort of is part of this progressive ideology, and they're going to college illiberal. So my argument would be that we need to provide parents with choice so that they can get out of the scenario and they have an opportunity to go to a school that is other than their local public school, which in too many areas has become completely radicalized.
Okay, so let me shift gears just a little bit because I'm interested again in some of maybe the real world experiences. You know, the premise of school choice in many respects is to bring market forces to bear on education. So, Bob, as you look at some of the market forces or the results, is there any evidence over the past year that suggests that, for instance, the availability of parochial schools or private schools, and particularly ones that were open and in class, would then drive decisions by the local public schools to be open and or how they conduct their education?
There's some evidence of that, but there's actually two other drivers of whether or not a public school closed or not and offered remote instruction to the exclusion of in-person learning. And those factors are, first, the partisan viewpoint of that school district. That is, frankly, whether you or not you voted for, that district voted for Donald Trump or Joe Biden, the more, the greater the percentage of, frankly, Trump voting in a given district, the more likely the public schools were to remain open, the more likely a district voted for Joe Biden, the more likely that school district would close. The second driver, frankly, has to do with the power and influence of a teacher union in that district. If you had a teacher union with collective bargaining rights in that school district, it is more likely than not, in fact, likely that that school district would be closed. Less relevant is the fact that there was a school choice program in that state. Although important, that kind of market force played a factor. If you want to take a closer look at this issue, there is a study done by the Annenberg Institute at Brown University that dove into these issues pretty deeply and take a look at the data, and their preliminary view of the situation, at least for that first year of the pandemic, is that it's, in terms of looking at whether or not public schools were closed, was the partisan divide, the power and influence of a local teachers union, and in a distant third was the availability of market force changers like school choice availability.
And so there are studies that show that when school choice programs become available, the public schools also improve. There are counter studies to those as well. This entire area, I think you should, whenever you see a study, take it with a grain of salt. I don't know how much any of you like follow internecine wars within economics, but there's recently like been people saying, people who used to think that they were in the mainstream in economics in the minimum wage debate have realized, wait, if I have a study that says that the minimum wage increase reduces employment, I'm going to have such huge blowback that I need to be like super tenured in order to publish that kind of study. And the exact same thing happened. School choice is an incredibly politicized area. And any scholar who comes out with a study showing that it works faces a tremendous amount of blowback. So I think to a certain extent, you need to go back to first principles. And in any other sector of the economy, so education, super important. We all agree with that. But so is food. So is transportation. And we don't create government monopolies, for grocery stores. And education is a good that parents and families are perfectly able of observing. You can see what are the test scores of my student on, you know, national standardized tests. Can my student read to grade level? And so if schools are falling down on that, parents can observe that and can make a choice. And so I think, if the market didn't work in education, that would be the surprising result. And so I think the onus is really on the opponents of choice to put forward an explanation for why competition doesn't work in education when it works in every other field. Because like education is really like, you know, the one of the very, very few areas where we still have a state monopoly on the ownership and provision of services.
Let me just survey, make sure I don't want to preempt. So if people have questions, I'm going to encourage you again to raise your hand or just shout if I'm not seeing it. There we go. Yes.
Thanks very much. And this is maybe going back a little bit to the prior discussion, but at the risk of sort of fighting the next battle before this one is resolved. So education finance is arguably in at least as much of a mess as healthcare finance is. And, you know, this is a wonderful example of the states being laboratories of democracy in terms of, you know, the money coming from some from local property taxes, some from state equalization values, some from federal sources, and anticipating the way things might go if local control has been one of the lodestars of control of local public school systems. If there's a local private school that is now collecting either federal tax dollars or local tax dollars that a significant portion of that community finds objectionable, to what extent does that dynamic start interfering here? And what's the clear path? What's the conservative, libertarian, or however you want to describe it? What is the analytical framework to kind of resolve that question? If I support, you know, the local Protestant school or Catholic school or whatever, whether or not I'm subscribed to their particular doctrine or even non-sectarian, but a madrasa opens up or someone creates a school, but the students that graduate from that school can't pass basic standardized tests, for example, is there some kind of a rubric where we need to demand value for money in terms of how we're funding education under the new paradigm?
You want to go ahead? Sure.
I have thoughts, but I'm happy.
My analytical rubric is that if the parents approve, then the parents approve, and it's their choice.
So I agree, but you know, in the real world, I do agree that this is, you know, there will be at least political pressure along the lines of this question. And so I think, you know, in states that have educational choice programs, there are still minimum requirements for schools to meet. So you can have, you know, basic requirements on what subjects have to be taught or how you know, basic proficiency to be eligible for a program. I don't think that isn't that controversial. But I think one thing that is very important is, you know, when you say laboratories of democracy, I think it's actually quite striking how little experimentation there is in schools. The curriculum that we have now in public schools throughout the country was essentially frozen in place in the middle of the 20th century. You know, we still have this inordinate emphasis on things like trigonometry, which I don't think that anybody uses a sine or a cosine in their everyday life, whereas we're not teaching things like statistical literacy as much as we should. And so I think that there's actually a huge amount of uniformity and very little experimentation, and that school choice would actually allow more models to be tested. You know, you can actually have Montessori schools versus Quaker schools versus schools that focus more on teaching STEM subjects or art subjects or whatever it may be. And so I think you'd actually have much more experimentation to see what best practices are and allow students to choose what's going to work for them. I was fortunate enough to be able to, my family had the resources that I could have gone to a private school, but I managed to get into a STEM magnet school and was able to go to that. It was a wonderful experience. You know, lots of students don't have those choices, and it would be wonderful if every student in the country, you know, when they're in 10th grade, decide, am I interested in STEM? Am I interested in the arts? And be able to go to a school that meets those needs.
But you're right to recognize this issue. This is an issue of institutional accountability. It's one that we grapple with in the higher education context all the time with the student loan program and the Pell Grant program, which, if you think about it, the Pell Grant program is basically a voucher program for any high school graduate to attend any Title IV approved school in the country. And the answers are not forthcoming there either. I mean, there are issues of metrics that colleges and the Department of Education and interest groups are constantly trying to grapple with.
Okay, so Ben, you ticked off some of the cases that have been significant school choice decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, Espinoza, certainly being the most recent of them. You've got Carson there this year. For reasons that I think are probably understandable, the cases that have to do with school choice in the courts tend almost always to have to do with sectarian institutions. Does it impact the ability to make the case for school choice, which seems to me maybe shouldn't always be just a sectarian, non-sectarian issue?
So I think that the answer goes back to what I was saying, that it's sort of a historical contingency that most of the schools that are available happen to be religiously affiliated. Because again, if you're being offered, if a state and locality are spending $20,000 on a public school, but you're going to have to eat the entire cost to go to a private school, you need to be very motivated to do that. And faith communities provide resources for that, and religious parents who want religious instruction have that strong motivation. And so I think that it's largely been based on that historical contingency, and the opponents of choice have sort of opportunistically used the Establishment Clause and these Blaine Amendments as, it's been the most effective weapon, so that's what they've used. But I think if you cleared the ground of all of those things and actually allowed choice to happen, then it would cease to be this sectarian versus non-sectarian issue. So in jurisdictions like Florida that have had school choice programs for a longer period of time, you actually do see a flowering of institutions that are not affiliated with a religious denomination. I think that that's exactly what you would expect. So, if you look at the private school system, at the high end, you see very, very expensive Catholic schools and Quaker schools and completely non-denominational schools, which are all levels of religiosity. And I think that if that option were not only available to wealthy people or the most wealthy people in society, you would see the exact same diversity arise. And so when you're not in this situation where you have to have these very particular interests to want to leave the public school system and you have the options to do that, I think you'd see the kind of diversity where this would no longer be a sectarian versus non-sectarian debate.
Let me, we have time for about one or two more questions. I don't know if anyone has any, but if not, I'm going to maybe ask, I've got two in mind. We'll see how long they take. So Bob, as we talk about the schools and you talk about the different places where people are enrolled. One thing I haven't heard much discussion about is for-profit versus non-for-profit private schools. Seems like, you know, if you want to experiment, giving people a profit motive arguably is a good way to make them do that. Where do those enrollments stand, and is that something that, that we should be looking to encourage or discourage, or what are each of your views as to that?
I don't have data on the enrollments for profit versus nonprofit. My view of this issue is that there's no difference between for profit education or for profit food or for profit healthcare or for profit housing or for profit transportation.
Yeah, so I would generally agree. And I think like at the K through 12 level, you know, you see charters and charter companies that are organized as not-for-profit and for-profit, which are both, they've both been successful at about similar rates. I think that there is a, it is quite well demonstrated that at the higher education level, lots of for-profit institutions have very famously more or less been scams. But I think that that is largely a function of what Bob was talking about, that you have this spigot of unlimited federal money, and the federal government is backing it up. And at the end of the day, like, those schools are going to get paid, nobody can default, and the government is going to guarantee it. And so I think that that is... less a, I agree, there's no reason in principle that for-profit versus not-for-profit should be the distinction. It's just that when you have this government spigot of money that's guaranteed, you know, you could have, it, there's a very strong incentive for hucksters to come in and make money from it. But if the government weren't simply guaranteeing those loans and it were more of a market system, I think you would see the distinctions disappear.
I would just respond to that to say that hucksterism doesn't really know tax-exempt status. There are any number of nonprofit institutions that have done an extraordinarily poor job of educating their students.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that.
Yep. All right. Well, we're due for a break, so I don't want to stand in the way of anyone in their break. Let's pause. I want to thank Ben and Bob for their participation on this panel. I think it's been pretty illuminating. Clearly know their stuff. So thank you both for coming up, and we'll take a few minutes and then we'll resume for our final panel of the day. Thanks, everybody.